Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Welcome to Noble Blood, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. Listener discretion is advised.
In 1837, just a few months before Queen Victoria would become the monarch of an empire at age 18, a group of six ambassadors arrived to England from the island of Madagascar. The six ambassadors had made the perilous journey from the eastern coast of Africa to London on behalf of their queen, the Queen of Imerna, Queen Ranavalina. Imerna, or the Merna Kingdom, was the largest and most powerful kingdom on the Madagascar island. It was dense with natural resources and had achieved military supremacy and near full island dominance during the reign of Rodima, who allied with the British Empire. But that allegiance ended the moment Rodima died and his wife, Ranavalina, became queen. Ranavalina tore up all the arrangements with European powers, ejected their ambassadors, and declared that the Merna Kingdom would exist under a policy of complete isolation, with an emphasis on returning back to native traditions and cultures. There would be no more Christian missionaries in Imerna. The Merna people who had already converted would be accepted for the time being, but by the end of her reign, they would suffer bloody persecution. Queen Ranavalina had one priority, to return Imerna to the way it had been before European settlers, and she would kill as many people as necessary in order to achieve her vision. I suppose that single-mindedness does reveal a second priority. Preserve her own power. Protect the crown at any cost. The six ambassadors who came to meet with the British King William IV were given a lovely diplomatic tour of England. They went to the Mint, the Dockyard, the Tower of London, the Zoological Gardens. But however pleasant their stay, the ambassadors refused to budge from their message. The Queen had sent them with two letters she dictated, in polite but unambiguous language. The law of her country would not be dictated by Europeans. Christianity would not be tolerated. Europeans were forbidden from living in Madagascar, with the exception of those soldiers taken as prisoners of war. To England, about to welcome their own queen to the throne, Ranavalina was an object of fascination. Depictions of her in Victorian sources range from bewilderment to outright racism. In contrast to tiny Queen Victoria, standing only 5 feet tall, a paradigm of domesticity and Christian femininity, Queen Ranavalina was terrifying. A bloodthirsty despot who would slaughter her own people or enslave them, who refused trade alliances with Europe, and who obeyed traditional rituals that, to 19th century Europeans, seemed strange and superstitious. The problem wasn't that she was a woman. No, of course not. Their next monarch was about to be a woman. But Victoria was going to be the right kind of woman. A civilized, domesticated woman. Ranavalina, they wrote, was what would happen if a woman allowed her basest, most heathenistic impulses to run unchecked. It's no wonder then that the few depictions we have of Queen Ranavalina in the English language are sparse and heavily woven with racism. She tops lists of the most bloodthirsty queens in history, often casually referenced as Queen Ranavalina the Bloody or Queen Ranavalina the Cruel. Recently, there's been a small school of thought that's attempted to recast her as a feminist hero, someone who fought off the imperialist forces in order to protect her kingdom. But that doesn't really fit her either. She's both, and she's neither. Ranavalina was cruel. Her reign was bloody. She was a selfish and paranoid ruler, but she was also politically adept and militaristically minded. She continued the expansion of the Mirna kingdom that her husband began. To this day, the few preserved relics of traditional Malagasy culture that we do have are mostly thanks to her. So I begin this podcast with the disclaimer that there are very few reliable English language sources that present a clear picture of Ranavalina's reign. Many of the writings come from the Christian missionaries that she expelled, who would have purposefully exaggerated their stories of her cruelty. All we can do is attempt to tease out what we do know from the sources we do have. The story beneath is of a distant and challenging woman who defied European supremacy. A woman who would rather kill than compromise. I'm Dana Schwartz, and this is Noble Blood. There are a few details about Queen Ranavalina's early life, but most historical accounts put her birth in 1788. Sometime during her childhood, her father saved the life of the Mirna king from an assassination attempt. In thanks, the king betrothed his son, Radama, to Ranavalina, and promised that she would be his senior wife, and that their children would be prioritized in the line of succession. The two were married, and in 1810, Radama's father died, and Radama became king of Inmerna. Radama was 17, and Ranavalina was 22. As a leader, Radama I focused on expansion. His priority was building up the Mirna kingdom to one day control the entire island of Madagascar. To that end, he made a deal with Great Britain. They would provide him with weapons and Western-style training for his army, and in return, Radama would eliminate slavery, which had been the cornerstone of most of the economies of the kingdoms on Madagascar. The deal with the British, which had been meant to secure the future of the Mirna economy, would in fact do the opposite. Eliminating the slave trade had been a strategic move on the part of the British, not one of benevolence. They undercut the economy of the kingdom, and before it could be rebuilt, they arrived in order to trade under incredibly lucrative and one-sided terms. If Madagascar could be made into a colony, all the better, to keep it from the French first. But more importantly, it was a strategic stronghold, a resource-rich island in the Indian Ocean. Under Radama I, nobles began to adopt a new Latin alphabet of the Malagasy language. A brief side note, the native language on Madagascar is spelled Malagasy phonetically, but pronounced, to the best of my ability and understanding, Malagas. The Malagasy written language had previously been closer to Arabic, and along with westernized militarization and language, Radama also welcomed Christianity. Missionaries thrived on the island, setting up schools and converting mostly lower-class Malagasy people. The queen watched all of this, but said nothing. Her husband's eagerness was understandable. They both wanted their kingdom to be strong. They both wanted to control the resources of Madagascar. But he didn't seem to understand the threat of Christianity. Christianity meant worshiping a new god, forgoing the spiritual traditions of the Malagasy people, the traditions that had given the monarchy its very power. The king was only the king because the blood of holy ancestors flowed through his veins. Radama died at age 35. Though the exact nature of his death isn't known, he was a heavy drinker, prone to fits of rage and violence when he was drunk. It was a combination of poor health, erratic behavior, and alcohol. His wife had given him no children, and so before his death, he decreed that the next in line for the throne would be his nephew. But Ranavalina was prepared. The night her husband lay dying, she gathered a small group of noblemen and military guardsmen and took the throne for herself, declaring herself queen. The nephew and the rest of her husband's family were brought to the palace. any one of them could have a claim to the throne, could declare that she was illegitimate and raise an army to oppose her. And so Ranavalina ordered that every single one of them be killed. Because there was a superstition that forbade spilling of royal blood, Ranavalina had every death done by strangulation. Hers would be a bloodless coup, technically. According to the writings of a missionary who was expelled by Ranavalina a few years later into her reign, during her coronation ceremony, the new queen was anointed with the blood of a freshly killed bull. That little anecdote, an attempt to paint her as primitive and barbaric, is almost certainly not true. There are no other sources corroborating that. What we do know about her coronation on May 27, 1829, is that she wore a dress in the French style, constructed from embroidered red velvet and silk, embroidered with her initials and rice stalks, a symbol of the indigenous plant life on the island. Her dress had a row of gold buttons. Ranavalina had specific tastes in her clothing. High-quality European fabrics and silhouettes, with specifically Malaga's details. Clothing wasn't the only thing that the new queen had strong opinions on. As soon as her coup was complete, she dissolved the treaty her husband had made with the British, both in terms of national and personal policy. Ranavalina was intensely private. Unlike members of the court, she refused to be photographed. She almost never spoke in public, perhaps insecure about her lack of complete literacy in the new written Malagasy alphabet, which would have made her unable to read long speeches. And so her few appearances in public were spectacles of red silk and imposing crowns. Her power was protected through fear and rumor, and she kept a close circle of nobles and officials with whom she consulted on matters of the state. Though Ranavalina never remarried, she did take a number of lovers after her husband's death, whom she would then make prime minister. But even they weren't immune from her wrath. Far from it. One of those lovers turned prime minister, a man named Andrea Mihaja, was chastised for his pro-European ideology, and so he was sentenced to undergo one of the ultimate horrors of Ranavalina's court, the Tangina ordeal. The idea of trial by ordeal was nothing new on Madagascar, nor was it something new in Europe, especially not during the witch trials, but Ranavalina gloried in it. During the Tangina ordeal, a suspect would be given a poisoned Tangina nut. He or she would then be forced to eat 3 pieces of chicken skin. If the poison forced them to vomit up all 3 pieces of chicken skin, they were innocent. If they failed to vomit up all 3 pieces, or the poison just killed them outright, that meant they were guilty and deserved to die. And the queen's lover refused to undergo the ordeal, and so he was killed on the spot. About 1 in 3 people who underwent the Tangina ordeal survived. Nobles and slaves alike were sentenced to the ordeal. When Ranavalina's niece died of whooping cough, all of the slaves that had served her were accused of witchcraft and sorcery and forced to undergo the ordeal. There were other Malagasy traditions that Ranavalina revitalized. Her spirituality revolved around the sun, or golden idols that were heavily guarded. And she made policies based on a process called sakid, which you threw dried beans on a board and used mathematical formulations to come to a decision. But Ranavalina was also one who recognized the utility of Western technology, especially when it came to technology that would help keep her island entirely self-sufficient. And a gift came to Madagascar in the form of a French adventurer by the name of Jean Laborde. In 1831, Jean Laborde was sailing off the coast of Madagascar, attempting to rescue treasure from other ships that had sunk in the Indian Ocean. Surprise, surprise, Laborde himself was shipwrecked, and thanks to a royal decree, everything and everyone that washed up on shore became property of the Myrna government. Laborde was summoned to Ranavalina's court. Laborde wasn't just an adventurer, he was also a brilliant engineer. And he and Ranavalina immediately struck up a mutually lucrative partnership. He would be given all of the land and resources he needed in order to manufacture military equipment for Myrna, so that Ranavalina would have no more need for trading at all. Laborde set to work. The man began with an arms and munitions factory, but soon he had created an entire city of production, complete vertical integration. He had blast furnaces to produce cast iron, pudding mills for wrought iron, a steel plant, cement plant, a textile mill. He produced not only cannons and swords, but bricks, tiles, pottery, glass, porcelain, silk, soap, and candles. The city he built, according to a Malagas novelist, had risen from the ground by the will of a single individual and the industry of a multitude. After all, Laborde didn't work alone. He had the assistance of as many slaves as he needed, thanks to the system in place in which the poor could pay their taxes, not with money, but through forced labor. Some claim, with no evidence, that Laborde and Queen Ranavalina became lovers. It may be a nice story, but there's no way to know one way or the other. She did have a son, born before Laborde arrived, by one of her early prime ministers. But she tactfully pretended that the father was her deceased husband, the king, even though mathematically that was impossible. But Laborde became a surrogate father to her son through mentoring him and teaching him. He would give him tours of his factories, teach him the science behind the technology. The two confided in each other, became each other's closest confidants as Ranavalina's reign began to become deadlier. And it was about to become far deadlier. In 1835, Ranavalina became sick with a mysterious illness. She lay in bed for days, a fever wetting her brow with sweat and distorting her vision. No one was allowed in or out of the palace, but word still traveled fast. The queen was going to die. But then, a miracle. One morning, when the sun shone through the windows of the new palace that Laborde had helped construct for her, Ranavalina had returned to health. It was a miracle, she knew, sent to her by the gods of her ancestors. And it was a sign that Christian missionaries needed to leave the island. She had tolerated Christianity for a while, tolerated it among the lower class of Malagas people. But Christianity had started to infiltrate the nobility. And Ranavalina knew that if it continued to spread, it would erode every cultural tradition that her kingdom maintained. Christianity would become a parasite, sucking at Myrna culture, blotting it out like ink on a page. Christianity was an invading force, and so Ranavalina became a queen at war. After her recovery, Ranavalina outlawed the baptizing of Malagas subjects, and she banished all of the non-native missionaries. The next year, she would begin executing not just the European Christians, but her own converted subjects. Christians who refused to renounce their new religion were subject to enslavement at best, or trial by ordeal and execution at worst. Missionaries returned home to Europe, salivating at the mouth with stories of Ranavalina's brutality and the martyrs of their sacrificed Christian brothers and sisters. There was a 37-year-old woman, they said, named Rasalama, who was speared to death and hurled over a cliff. Other Christian converts were burned at the stake or boiled alive or brutally dismembered. There are estimates that by 1848, one-fifth of the native population of Imerna had been killed through the Tangina ordeal. There are some estimates that any given servant who had worked under Ranavalina for 20 years would have survived 7 ordeals. 7 times taking the poison, vomiting up all 3 chicken skins to prove their innocence. European powers would see Ranavalina's ruthlessness in person one more time before her reign was over. In 1845, the queen declared that all European trade would be cut off entirely. The British and French stirred uncomfortably. Madagascar was a prime and important location. Those resources were incredibly valuable, and it would make an incredibly lucrative colony. And so, in a rare moment of cooperation from historic enemies, the British and French joined forces to jointly attack the coast of Madagascar. Ranavalina annihilated the advance almost immediately. The British and French were fooled by a primitive, cheap facade on the island's coast. Behind it was the real fortress. The European vessels were forced to flee, and the soldiers that had attacked on the shore were quickly dispatched with. Ranavalina had their skulls, the skulls of 20 European casualties, affixed to pikes and placed on the shore to ward off any future attacks. There were no polite diplomatic apologies. "I find it very odd," Ranavalina said, "that the British and French would interfere in my affairs. How would Queen Victoria and Louis Felipe take it if I were to meddle with their countries? I have as much right to nail my enemy's head at the end of a pole as Queen Victoria has to send her prisoners into exile." The humiliating defeat for the European powers was better retold then as a story of Ranavalina's evil and brutality, her, quote, unparalleled reign of terror and fear. Ranavalina's final challenge would come another decade later when she put down a coup from a wealthy French-European slave trader who had managed to entice to his side the two men Ranavalina held closest to her, her son and Laborde. The French slave trader, a man named Lambert, wrote a charter giving himself the right to exploit all of the minerals and forests of Madagascar with a provision to give 10% to the monarchy. He went around to the courts of Europe, attempting to gather support and raise an army. It would be a lucrative proposition if they succeeded and overthrew Ranavalina. They were sure that they could convince her son to sign the agreement. But the sting of past defeat put off England and France from another attempt to challenge Ranavalina. And so, without a European army, Lambert came directly to Madagascar himself and managed to win the support of the Crown Prince and the engineer Lombard. They had seen the queen's ruthlessness firsthand and her viciousness. Imerna was isolated and traditional, yes, but at what cost? Maybe the future was European. And so the prince agreed to join in on the rebellion. It failed almost instantly. For all of the depictions of Ranavalina as a hedonistic madwoman, she was an efficient and effective leader with a network of spies and the loyalty of her military. After the small coup was dispatched of, her son was forgiven. He was just a young man led astray. But after that, she banished all Europeans from Imerna, including Laborde. He had been a close friend and confidant for over 25 years, but he had betrayed her. He left Madagascar on her orders and returned to France. For a queen, they said, was insane and bloodthirsty. It struck me as odd that he would be allowed just to leave and return home. After all, that's a strategic decision to protect her kingdom from French retaliation. To me, sending Lombard home reads as a woman who was less emotional in her violence, less, well, insane than the writings of angry Europeans and vengeful missionaries would have led you to believe. There are only a few Malagas women who wrote accounts of Ranavalina, but one is a woman named Rani Raka, who wrote in a letter after Ranavalina's death, "The late queen is not so cruel as she's been represented. Many of her subjects have really been killed by her orders, but it was not wanton cruelty. It was through the laws of her late predecessors. You have seen her. She is intelligent." It's estimated that during Ranavalana's reign, as many as 50% of the Merna population was killed. And thanks to both her torture and executions, but also from the famine caused by the scorched earth policies her armies took when it came to enemy kingdoms. From Ranavalana's perspective, violence wasn't capriciousness. She was a woman who believed fiercely in the religious rite of the Tanjuna ordeal, which allowed the gods to decide who lived and who didn't. She was steadfast in that, not making decisions based on anger or emotions. If people needed to die, so be it. But the Merna people as a whole wouldn't die. That was the important thing, preserving the kingdom itself. That's the story of the, quote, bloody Queen Ranavalana. But stick around after a brief sponsor break to hear about her death and what happened next.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary. Indulges your senses and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.
After the queen's death, her son and then her son's wife took over the throne, and in Merna almost immediately reverted back to European influence. The Franco-Hova Wars, which began in 1883, led to the end of the Merna Kingdom and the creation of the French Protectorate, which then became the colony of Madagascar. French claims to the property that Laborde had left in Madagascar, gifts from the queen, became the pretext for their armed invasion. There's one detail about Queen Ranavalana's funeral that seems worth mentioning. The queen died in her sleep at age 83 after a 33-year-long reign. But during the funeral, an errant spark flashed and caused a nearby barrel of gunpowder to explode. Several bystanders were killed. Even in death, Ranavalana maintained her reputation.
Noble Blood is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. The show is written and hosted by Dana Schwartz and produced by Aaron Mankey, Matt Frederick, Alex Williams, and Trevor Young. Noble Blood is on social media at Noble Blood Tales, and you can learn more about the show over at NobleBloodTales.com. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.